From the beginning of the pandemic, there were oddities. Spin started from the get-go, and not just from China. Stories changed, rationales changed, and the data, of course, changed, which is to be expected, but the reporting on the data was often deceptive. And then there's the models. Models that make climate science look like settled science. I was an early adopter of masks, but an early opponent of mandates and lockdowns. I was suspicious of the origin story from day one, the origin story of SARS-CoV-2. And our darkest conspiracy worries have evidence to back them up. The folks prescribing policy lied to us. Fauci admitted as much in congressional testimony, at least regarding masks. Now, the lockdown idea was new and untried, but it has become an orthodoxy overnight. Much of this is obviously ideological. The progressive reliance upon the expertise of credentialed bureaucrats and consultants has emerged more clearly than ever. Well, never before have experts proven themselves dolts or worse. So with that in mind, let's explore this further. Here begins episode 18. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Locofoco Netcast. We're here to talk pandemic, but before we get too far, we should each introduce ourselves, because each of us has a name that might be a puzzle to some of us, right? Most normal people would look at our names and might have a difficulty pronouncing what we are. So my name is Timo Virkola. That's Timothy Virkola. That's Timothy Workman Virkola. And I'm at Workman on Gab and Locals.com and other social media. The last name is Finn Virkola. I don't know if you catch that as a Finn thing. The middle name is the Frisian cognate, and it's spelled with an I and not an O. So Lee, who are you?
I'm Lee Wakes. I live in the Philadelphia area. My last name is just a made-up last name to avoid detection by, well, my grandfather. He wanted to avoid detection by the college admissions agencies, I guess, because he was Jewish, and there was a lot of discrimination back then. So he wanted to make sure he could get into dental school. But anyway, so I'm actually only half Jewish, but not that that matters. And we are talking to Olaf, formerly lived in Sweden, well, Swedish native, and lives in the U.S. now. You want to introduce yourself, Olaf?
Sure, yes, absolutely. Olaf here. Yes, I was born and raised in Sweden. Moved when I was, you know, I lived in New York City for about a decade, and now I am residing in Central Florida. I work as a data scientist, so that's what I occupy myself with.
And we're also talking to Rocco. Go ahead, Rocco.
Yes, my name is Rocco Lucenti. I'm one of the co-hosts of the Liberty Conservative podcast. I've been a liberty activist for pretty much my entire adult life, going back to the Ron Paul campaigns. And I'm, you know, very excited to come here and talk about this very important topic. Obviously, what's going on with COVID is extremely important, and it's worth talking about in these liberty circles that we're in.
All right, so why don't we get started with Rocco? We're gonna do a little Watergate interrogation. If you're a little, you're kind of young, Rocco. I say I'm 55, and you look like you're about, well, under 30, possibly.
Yeah. But,
okay, so we're gonna start off with, what did you know, and when or how did you know it? That's kind of a Watergate question. So when did your skepticism kick in about COVID-19?
Well, you know, I was really skeptical from right off the bat. It was very difficult for me to see things as being as serious as people were saying they were going to be. And part of that was because of the data that came out of China, which we ended up finding out was not necessarily the best data. But that was the initial thing which led me to think that this might not be as bad as people are saying. There was only a few thousand deaths in China at the time, and we had people saying that we are going to have millions of hospitalizations, possibly tens of millions, and that we were going to have anywhere from high hundreds of thousands to low millions in deaths. And I was skeptical of that conclusion from right off the bat. But really, I think that the moment that sprung me as an all-out skeptic of the narrative that this is as bad as some of these predictions had said it was going to be was when Neil Ferguson of the Imperial College revised down his model. And to be clear, he didn't revise it down as much as some people said he did. There were people who said that he revised his predictions down by something like 95%, and that wasn't exactly accurate, because his high-end prediction was somewhere, I believe, around 500,000, and he ended up revising that down to about 20,000 deaths predicted in the UK at the time. And when he revised it down, he actually quoted a rate of spread that was higher than what he had thought before. And that triggered my alarm bell, because I'm not a data scientist. I'm not somebody who's necessarily familiar with the medical data. But if the rate of spread goes up and your death count for that rate of spread goes down, then it seems to me that you've really revised down your model. And it's something that never got resolved so much in the popular conversation, but it started to trigger my skepticism toward this. And then the next big moment that really put me over the top was in mid-April, when the hospitalizations in New York peaked around 18,800, and the ICUs, I believe, 2 or 3 days later, peaked at around 5,200. And we were being told that we were going to need, you know, tens of thousands more hospital beds, up to 50,000 more hospital beds than what we had in the state. And it turned out that our existing capacity, those stretched in New York City for sure, and they had to go to surge capacity. And there was even a little bit brought in that got used at very low rates. It got used nonetheless, but it was at a very low rate. But it wasn't what we were told that it was going to be, is the point. And in everywhere but New York City, it was far below what we were told it was going to be. And I thought that, you know, we might have a change in what was going on in our public policy response at that point. But things only seemed to get more and more drastic as time went on. So, you know, I'm sure we'll get a little bit more into that. I think that's a good enough introduction for how I got there. But I really was a skeptic from the beginning, but it sort of escalated as time went on.
Right. Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the New York Times, former New York Times reporter. He left before he would have been fired, I suppose. If you've seen the recent letter from Barry Weiss. Well, she wasn't fired, but I think she saw the writing on the wall. Anyway, if you're familiar with Alex Berenson, he said that he was actually a little frightened based on some numbers that he was seeing coming out of China. But then again, he probably thought they weren't that reliable anyway. We can all put ourselves on guard, at least, just in case. And so he said he was a little scared, but then he started to look at actually the King's College numbers, in fact, because of he looked at the fact that it was mainly old people that were dying, sort of started his spidey senses tingling, shall we say. Anyway, Olaf, what turned you into a skeptic?
Right. So, yeah, I agree with a lot of what Rocco said. And I think the most important part to remember here, the paper coming out of Imperial College in London was never peer-reviewed. It was never published. So this is a paper that, you know, didn't go through the rigor academic standard that every other paper does. But I think it's the only probably paper in the world that was never published, never peer-reviewed, that has had such a disastrous effect on public policy around the world. Like, they based everything on this, on the data, on the modeling from Neil Ferguson coming out of the paper from Imperial College that was never even published. So that's a little bit crazy to me to think that that's what they went with. So I'm not someone who says, you know, this virus is nothing and there's nothing to be, you know, you shouldn't be cautious and this is a hoax or whatever. I think it's a danger for some people, and I recognize that, and I think it's reasonable to take it, you know, relatively seriously. But what they have done in response to it is what kind of flips me out a lot. It's, you know, I think that what they have done in response will have far worse consequences and effects on society in the long run than the virus itself. And I don't see it that's scarcely debatable anymore. I mean, what they have done and what the long-term effects will be lingering for how long, I don't know, but it seems like, you know, 40 to 50 million people out of work in the U.S. alone. And if we were to count, like, unemployment statistics the way they did during the Great Depression. This is already worse than the Great Depression. Or maybe now has regained a little bit recovery, but when it was, you know, at its worst, it was really bad. And so, and then I see, you know, all these, there's no statistical correlation whatsoever between, you know, a lower fatality rate and shutting down society. That's another thing that, you know, kind of raises a red flag, that this, how much does this have to do with the virus? And how much is it that they're just using it as an excuse to drive something else? And what is that something else? What is the end goal? And that is what worries me.
Rocco, what do you think that end goal is? You probably have some ideas, some suspicions.
Well, you know, it's really a great question, because what they've been doing is fundamentally irrational. I mean, the data that's come out from the United Nations about the people who will be put at risk of starvation because of this, the data that's come out about the increase in calls to the suicide hotlines, the increases in drug overdoses. I mean, in the United States, in May, we had a 42% increase in heroin overdoses. And this is something that has a massive death impact, which impacts younger people mostly, when the age stratification of this virus mostly impacts the not just old, but the very old. I mean, it seems that the average age of death of this virus is either as old or older than the average age of death in America as it stands today. But to answer your question about what do I think the agenda at play here is, you know, I try not to be a conspiracy theorist, and I try not to presume people have fundamentally evil motives. I don't think that anybody was necessarily trying to crush their own economy on purpose. But I think that when you start to do something like this, when you decide that you are going to shut down, it has to be justifiable, because you're going to put millions of people out of work. And if it ends up not being all that serious in people's minds, let's say that it fizzles out immediately and nothing happens, then you're only going to have millions of people mad at you. Nobody's going to consider you a hero. So the second you pull the trigger on a lockdown, the second you pull the trigger on such a serious policy measure, you are fundamentally connected to how that policy unfolds and to the level of necessity of that policy. And you have a political interest in escalating the degree to which you are saying that policy is necessary. And if the data begins to diverge from the idea that it was necessary, then your political interest really isn't in saying that. Your political interest is more in hiding that as much as you can. And it is in making claims about the notion that what you did was what caused the spread to stop, and that what you did was what mitigated these things, even though most of the modeling was accounting for the social distancing measures that you had put into place. So I think that a lot of it's pure political interest. I think that a lot of it is also about the 2020 election in terms of people's reticence to give in to anything that Donald Trump wants to do and to say that he's been correct on anything whatsoever. And I think that those are really the main motivating factors at the moment.
Right. Well, I saw someone joke on Facebook, I guess it was, that Trump derangement syndrome is a worse virus than COVID-19. And to me, what that illustrates is the fact that there is a large degree of tribalism, of course. That's natural. We all root for our political team. All groups do it. And we're all prone to bias, no matter what. I mean, we imagine we're being objective, but it's really hard thing to do, because we're all fallible human beings, right? But it's interesting to me that those, you know, the typical Karens out there, as they're mocked, that are, you know, have this Trump derangement syndrome or orange man bad or whatever you want to call it, or just not even necessarily politically motivated. They don't necessarily have to be for or against Trump. I think they were thoroughly convinced that this was a genuine threat. And then once they're on board with that, you have a difficulty convincing them that it wasn't really anything close to the threat that they thought it was. And getting people to back away from those type of commitments is very difficult. And I found that phenomenon interesting. I mean, we see it all the time with regard to many different public policy issues. But I just find that that's a big problem out there. So it's not even an issue of partisan politics per se, or it is in a sense, they join together so naturally, right? So once you have someone who's already partisan, and then they're convinced that the COVID-19 is a genuine threat and Trump isn't doing his job or somebody's not doing his job, then you get this strong emotional factor involved, and it's hard to dissuade people that we should abandon the lockdowns. And people get backed into a corner as well. And I tend to preach the idea that we should welcome these people back to the fold of rationality, whatever you want to call it. I mean, sure, we can point out the devastation, but we don't really want to put that burden on them necessarily, because that's guilt. That's a lot of guilt. So to get people to, don't we really just want to get rid of the lockdowns, right? And so, but when you introduce the partisan aspect and you want to blame people, this is your fault, you've destroyed millions of lives. Nobody wants to take responsibility for that. Don't you think we need to give these people an out? Would you say so, Rocco or Olaf?
When you opt for something like this, when you opt for a draconian measure like this, and then you have to stick with it. It's very hard to scale back and admit that you were wrong, because now your political career is at stake. You lose credibility and you might lose, your career might be destroyed in the next election. You don't want that. So what the psychological pattern seems to be is that instead of doing the right thing, is that they double down on it. They double down on the same thing because they have to stick to it now. They have to find any justification possible to prove that, you know, they did the right thing, even though they know that they didn't, because otherwise it might have very, very bad consequences for them, you know, in their future career in public office, holding public office. And I think that's one thing that drives them to never give up this position. And that's why, of course, everybody, you know, love the most hated country in the world right now is Sweden, the country that the leftists, the progressives used to love and praise for everything that they had. Now suddenly have turned around and they hate them. They hate them for not wearing masks. They hate them for not mandating masks. They hate them for not imposing a lockdown, and try to find any sort of reason to write a smear piece and attack them from you know, a dozen different media outlets. It's very revealing to see what kind of tactics they're using to justify what they have done.
Why don't you talk about Sweden? Sweden is often compared to Finland and Norway and Denmark, mm-hmm. in terms of the number of deaths, and they are drastically different, it appears.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that, though?
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, if you compare to Finland, Norway, and Denmark, Sweden looks pretty bad. But if you then were to compare to other countries who had some of the most strict, like home arrest, quasi-home arrest measures in place, countries like Italy, Spain, the UK, Belgium, and others too. And then you go to the US and you look at the states who were the most restrictive, who did, you know, the most draconian stuff too, like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maryland, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and I'm probably missing some here, but Sweden looked very good compared to those states too, and they had far stricter measures in place. So it's comparing Sweden to just, you can cherry pick. I mean, I can play that game too. I just did.
Is it possible to explain the difference, though? Why did Finland and Norway and Denmark do so well, relatively speaking?
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the reasons, but one of the reasons why Sweden's death toll is much higher than theirs is that Sweden did not manage to keep the virus out of the nursing homes. That was pretty bad. What happened? Like it came in almost half. Some say it's more. Some say it's 60-70%. That's not the numbers I've heard them tell me, but they wouldn't surprise me if they were hiding these numbers because it was pretty tragic. But at around 50%, and that's, you know, numbers that they have admitted to, of the fatalities have occurred in these places. These are very, very old and fragile people. Right. And the tragedy here is that it doesn't come as a surprise to me because these places are poorly run to begin with. They're very poorly run. They're all run by the government. I hear bad stories every year of neglect in these places of the elderly.
And there are huge numbers in these nursing homes compared to some of the other countries.
Oh, yeah, they
it's like
manage
they're gigantic
somehow.
Warehouses for old people, I've heard. Not that I've checked into it, but that's what I heard.
Yeah, they're is that true? Sometimes there are hundreds of them living there. Or it depends. It could be smaller, too. But there are some larger ones, at least in Stockholm, an area of Stockholm that is pretty densely populated. And if the virus managed to get in there, it can get pretty bad. And, you know, they, like I said, they're not managed very well normally either. Every year, like I hear stories about neglect going on. I'm like that. That's not a place I want to end up living in at the end of my life. But these are very, very old people. And it tells you something about the disease. This is not the disease that will hit and hurt the reasonably healthy middle-aged and young people. There's no reason you should, you know, confine them to imprison them in their own homes. That explains a lot. I'm not sure what Norway and Finland and Denmark did. They might have smaller. I've heard from other people who live there that those homes are smaller. There are fewer people living in them. That could be one reason, and they might run them better too, or they just, I don't know. It's bad luck too that because they like to say this, right? Well, you didn't do enough. Well, one of the restrictions that were actually mandated by the Swedish government, and there were not many, there were just a few. But one of the restrictions that they harped on a lot and stressed a lot, you cannot visit these places. We're locking them down. Those were the places that were locked down, and those were the places that were hit. So again, what they did didn't even work. They did take measures against visitation in these places and didn't allow people to enter, only, you know, personnel. And yet they couldn't keep the virus out. So again, it didn't work. If you're talking about, you know, you want to impose more restrictions, well, it didn't even work. So, yeah, I mean, it's sad, but again, you can't just cherry pick. And I love it when they, you know, take Sweden, then they put it against the United States of America of 324 million people, this giant land mass, and compare the little Scandinavian country and think that that's like a valid statistical comparison. It's absurd. It's like saying, okay, well, if Sweden is doing worse than Wyoming, Nebraska, and Hawaii, then they must have failed. Is that what you're telling me? That's crazy. You compare them to, you know, equally sizable countries within the U.S., which would be the states, and look how they have done. And then you can make some more reasonable, draw some more reasonable conclusion. And it's not that there is any connection at all between shutting down the economy and locking down the country, that would lead to a lower fatality rate. That correlation doesn't even exist. So, let alone causation, you know, correlation is not even there.
Right. Olaf, I noticed on your Facebook page, I believe your avatar says, go outside. And yeah. I understand that Finland has a very, very hot summer, that they're talking about global warming again because it's so warm this year. Mm-hmm. So maybe some of the old people actually went outside.
It has been encouraged. It's not like they're telling you to stay inside either. They're encouraging you to go outside. As every single day, I've listened to the press conference. I've taken notes and I have downloaded the data and looked at the data and transformed the data into some meaningful stuff. And what they're saying is go outside because it's good for your immune system. We want you to be outside because otherwise you're going to be vitamin D deficient and that's not good for you. So that's encouraged, not discouraged. Probably some old people did go outside, but then again, you're confined to like these courtyards. So it's not like people could visit you anyway. You know, these places aren't very, they're sort of enclosed complexes.
I noticed on your Facebook page, Rocco, that you are keeping track of the second wave, any alleged second wave. And that's a thing that people are concerned about. I sent you an Atlantic Magazine article. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. They're talking about the rise in cases and that we shouldn't be surprised about a second wave. Do you have some thoughts on that?
You know, I do, but I just want to add a little bit on the point about Sweden right now. You know,
sure.
It's important, I think, when we talk about Sweden to remember what we were told was going to happen on the basis of their policy that they had implemented. The Imperial College of London model predicted that they were going to suffer more than 85,000 deaths as a result of the policy that they implemented. And even if they imposed a European-style lockdown similar to Italy and a couple of these other nations, they were still supposed to have in the area of 35, 40,000, and they didn't even get close to that. I mean, I think they're at 55, 5,600 at the moment. So it's not even remotely within the realm of what they were saying. And I think that we need to confront people with this fact over and over again, quite frankly, because they lied about what was going to happen if you allowed people to have freedom. And Sweden proves that. And they want to move the goalposts and say, oh, well, what about Denmark? What about Norway? What about all these other nations who have slightly fewer deaths? When the reality is that 5,600 deaths in a nation of 10 million people, when you said that there was going to be mass graves as a result of this policy, it's clear that what they did was the more cautious, the more reasonable, and the more correct approach, and the economic data out of the country shows it as well. But to answer your question about the case spike that we've had going on, the so-called second wave, I think that it's important to remember that in most of these places, this really is an initial wave. It's really the first time that there has been a spike in cases in those states, places like Florida, places like Texas. They didn't really get hit at first by this. They had some cases for sure, but they did not have the kind of spike that you're seeing right now. And what we've seen is the sort of rapid case growth, which would be indicative of that. But that being said, the death tolls, which have gone up some, there's no doubt about that, they have not followed the rapid rise in cases. And I think that, you know, really I'm watching Worldometers very, very closely this week and looking at the state by state and seeing what's going on to see if we end up having a major death spike week over week, because last week was the first week that we did have a little bit of an increase. And if that continues this week, and that's a sign that there is a little bit of a problem. And so far it hasn't. So far it's pretty much flatlined. And just judging on where we are at this moment today, which that's always dangerous when Texas and California come in at the end. But, you know, judging by where we are right now at this moment, things look fairly good. So, you know, I think that the important thing with the case spike is that you have to look at the hospital capacities in these states. You have to look at what's going on in the places where there are hospitalizations that are rising and whether or not those rises in numbers actually correlate with the problem with dealing with the additional capacity. I mean, right now there's more than 23% hospital bed capacity in the state of Florida, and their ICUs have more than 18% capacity, and that is well beyond what these places normally run at in terms of vacancy. You know, typically during normal times, these hospitals are not going out there and trying to keep as many beds as they can open. This is a COVID thing. This is something that they've done in reaction to this virus. So I think it's important to remember that the hospital capacity is the real issue. This is what they told us we needed to lock down over. And if it's not a problem in the places where we're having these case spikes, which so far it doesn't seem to be, there seems to be plenty of capacity at the moment. And if it continues at that rate, then I think that it's just more of an argument to continue to reopen the country.
Right. I expected a second wave of sorts, because once people are out there and being exposed to other people who might actually be sick or asymptomatic or whatever, that they might get sick and some of them might end up in the hospital. But that doesn't mean we're not on the tail end there of a decline, a considerable decline in deaths, just because you get a little spike here and there. So there's a little bit of triumphalism, as we see in the Atlantic article that I mentioned, but that could be extremely premature. And I think there was an Israeli epidemiologist, I could be wrong, but he was saying that there was a 70-day cycle for this thing. It's not exactly 70 days when you look at when it started and when it started to end, but in terms of like when deaths really started increasing and then when they started declining, it is about 70 days. And because the virus has basically killed off most of the people it's going to kill, and then it's mutated possibly into something less virulent, and now we're in that tail end. So we've seen the worst of it, most likely. So I think maybe the people who are concerned about a second wave are actually premature, which I think is what you're saying, correct?
Well, I think that it's more than they're premature. I think that this whole thing has been a bait and switch from the very start, because the fact of the matter is that we were told that the reason to lock down, the reason to put these measures in, was to preserve hospital capacity so that people did not have a situation where they're showing up to the hospital with a serious case of COVID and not being able to get a hospital bed. And people need to remember, you know, I live in the state of New York, and our New York, our lead COVID expert, his name is Michael Osterholm. And back in March, he did an interview on the Joe Rogan podcast where he went out there and said that we could have anywhere from 2 to 24 million hospitalizations in the United States as a result of the coronavirus. And it seems right now that we're around 350,000, you know, between 350 and 400. It's a little bit difficult to tell because the numbers change every week. But it's far, far below, you know, multiple times below what their lowest case estimates were. And, you know, in New York, they got it wrong enough. But in places like Oklahoma and places like, you know, Tennessee and some of these Midwestern and Southern states, it was even more embarrassingly off base than it was in states like New York. So I think that, you know, we really have to keep that in mind. And we have to remember that this whole thing has sort of been a bait and switch from the very start. And that if we want to make sort of the correct argument in favor of not having these lockdown measures, in favor of not creating these policy measures which have destroyed a lot of people's lives, then we need to remind people of what these things were actually designed to do. We were not supposed to be doing this to try to end all death of COVID. We were actually told at the start of this that there was no way to lower the death toll, and that lowering the death toll was not something we were going to be able to do, and the point was to spread it out. And ironically, it seems like places like Texas and Florida have spread it out, and now they're getting a lot of crap for that because they have Republican governors. But, you know, it is what it is, and I think that at this point it's to parrot Alex Jones, it's an info war. It's a war of information, and we need to get out there and we need to push the relevant data and the info that is actually pertinent to the danger of this to people, and remind them of how we got here, what was promised, and what actually unfolded.
I agree with all of that, but I do want to repeat what I said earlier, and maybe you disagree. I think we do want to give these people, it won't necessarily be the politicians, but we do want to give a lot of people who have doubled down, as Olaf said, a chance to back away. So we do want to hold people accountable for sure, but we don't want to make them feel guilty because in many cases, they were the victims of propaganda. They weren't propagandizing themselves. They sincerely believed that this was a threat. And of course, there was that element of partisanship, but we're all partisan, we're all biased. So we do want to give people a chance to back away. But I can understand that people would be angry if we destroyed the economy for no reason at all, right?
Well, yeah.
Not no reason, but not a, let's, you know, a quote unquote justifiable reason without regard for cost. Go ahead.
You know, I take your point, Lee. I definitely take your point that it is, that you don't want to rub people's faces in it, so to speak. You don't want to make them feel as if they supported the most disastrous public policy failure since the Great Depression, which is what they did. But you don't want them to feel that way because it's not all that productive. But at the same time, we've gotten into a situation where the unfortunate truth is that this has become political. And it's highly political at the moment. I don't think it was necessarily at the start, but with where we are right now, I think that if you are the average Republican voter, you were sort of more predisposed just based on personality, based on ideology, based on a couple of factors to look at this as something that we could get past, hopefully very quickly, and reopen the economy up and try to get things back on track. And I think that you had trust in the president in many cases, and that sort of influenced your thinking in that regard. So I think that a lot of Republican voters came around very quickly, also in part because there were many of us who were deeply resentful of these measures from the very start. And I think that when you have that core group who are on your side typically, who are making these arguments, it's very easy to go to their side. But when you are on the other side of the aisle and the only people who are making these arguments are people who you perceive as your political enemies, then admitting they're right on this might mean admitting they're right on other things, admitting that they're right on some crucial issues, and that, you know, you go down a slippery slope in your mind of what you might have to concede to if you concede on this one issue. And I think that really holds a lot of people back. And I think that it really prevents some people who are more partisan from, you know, taking a stronger look at the evidence. And it really is unfortunate.
Right. I like unavoidable, though, right?
Well, I think it is unavoidable in one sense, because we're dealing with something deeper than partisanship, aren't we, really? Because we have here is that progressivism is on the line. Progressives have always believed that policy should be made by experts. Experts who are credentialed, are in the bureaucracies, or are consultants. And this was driven by experts in the bureaucracies, like Fauci, and in consultants, like the character in Great Britain, whose name I always forget, because it's very much like the historian. Neil Ferguson. They like this because what has progressivism always been about? It's the liberty of all must be taken away for the benefit of the underprivileged or the at risk, right? We can't have capitalism, we can't have freedom, free markets, because the poor will be hurt very, very much. Now, it's a bizarre idea, but that is what their idea is. And this, they have a group of people who are susceptible to being devastated by the virus. And the experts are telling them that the thing to do is to take away all our liberty so that we can save those people. And that's a huge, huge impetus for them to just throw out all reason and become religious maniacs in this cause of the lockdowns. So how do you get by that?
Yeah, no, it's funny because, well, it's not funny, but it's kind of, when you look at the narrative and how it has unfolded, from the beginning, it was never even proposed. It was never an idea to escape the virus altogether. That was never the point of this. The point was to stretch the curve. They call it flattening the curve, but it's really stretching it. The area under the curve is the same. They just want to stretch it to give us more time, give the hospitals more time to deal with sick people. That was the whole idea. And that turned then into, oh, we can't have any viruses. We can't have any cases at all. We need to move to zero cases or else we can't open up. That's insane. Like, you look at similar viruses that have been going around. These things don't go away. They usually come back. I mean, the seasonal flu come back every year. So it's really crazy how they have manipulated this whole narrative into we just need to have some restrictions in place so that we can deal with all the sick people and, you know, give us more time to, we can't, if there's one sick person, we can't open up anything. We need to avoid the virus altogether, which is, of course, ridiculous if you just think about it.
Right. But the virus is still out there, though, right? And there are still huge numbers of vulnerable people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, yeah. 90s, 100 plus.
And people tend to freak out when they have imposed something like a lockdown. It's very tough. It's very hard to climb out of it. Like, how do you climb out? What do you open up first? Okay, so you're going to start opening up some businesses, maybe. And then you see, okay, so there's a little regional outbreak here. What are you going to do? Are you going to lock down everything again then and try something else? Once you've imposed this, it's really hard. It's really, really hard to walk, to climb out of it because you're going to panic every time you see some little surge of regional cases coming up, which is why it's nice to see, you know, that some, and I attack Sweden pretty much all the time. I was born and raised there and lived there for a long time. But I can say when they do something right, like what they have done is actually sustainable. Like they can carry this strategy for pretty long, like probably years if they had to. Like they just say, you know, keep a distance. What are the most important hands? What are the most important things that we have known for like 200 years or so? It's like washing hands. We've known that for about 150 years. That reduces the spread of infection. And keeping a little distance to people, that's much more important than wearing a mask. That's what they say, too. And the reason they give is this, and it's interesting. The paradoxical thing of wearing a mask is that people now think that they are safe, that they can't catch the virus. And that allows them to go, you know, into these situations which they otherwise would not go into because they think that they're protected now. And of course, they're not. So, and instead of like what they say in Sweden, too, they say, well, if you have symptoms, you should stay home. Don't go outside. If you have symptoms, you don't put on a mask and go outside because that's not going to do anything. That's not going to, people will get sick. You'll spread a disease. And that, I think, is what will happen if you start like encouraging or even mandating masks, that people think now that this is some kind of like protection shield that would allow them to, you know, stay in close, very close proximity, gather together. And they think like, oh, it's OK, I have a mask, so I won't get sick. Well, that's not true. I mean, the most important thing, if you don't want to get sick, is probably to keep a little distance to people, which is what the. What they say, but now this mask will give them this false sense of security. And I think that can actually hurt people. Like old vulnerable people can get hurt if you have this false sense of security. This is your security blanket, and you can't get people sick, and you can't get sick yourself. So you let down your guard, and you don't care anymore, which is could be dangerous if this virus is harmful to some people. That's the kind of behavior you don't want to see. You still want people to be reasonable and kind of like don't go and cough and close to somebody else. I mean that and just because you have a mask and think that that's going to help, which, you know, so wear these kind of masks, I believe, can have the opposite effect of what they want them to have.
Right. So the virus is still out there, Rocco. What do we do? What do we do with all those old folks that are worried about cutting their lives short by 1 to 2 years or 3 to 4 years? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, no, it's a good question. And I think that one of the interesting pieces of data that I saw came from Dr. John Ioannidis out of Stanford. And he did a study on the stratification of COVID deaths. And what he found was that about 92% of the deaths are coming from about 9% of the population. And, you know, a lot of those are older people. Some of them are. There are some younger people who are in high-risk categories. But, you know, really it's about 92% of the deaths that are coming from about 9% of the population. And when you look at the age stratification of it, it's really an extreme age stratification. When you look at the CDC provisional death count, about 59.5% of the deaths that have come in have been people who are 75 and over, and about 80% of them have been people who are 65 and over. Right now, the number of people who are 54 and younger who have died of COVID between February 1st and now, according to the CDC provisional death count, is 9,222.
You said the cutoff was 54?
Yeah, 54 and under.
See, I'm 55. Now I'm nervous. Do I need to be worried?
Well, you know, I'm not a doctor, so far be it from me to give anybody personal advice. I mean, I have steered clear from that from the very beginning, and I will
continue. Hold on now, though. Hold on. You have been giving personal advice in a sense because you recently lost a staggering amount of weight, and you've been emphasizing the fact that a lot of people who are obese and have the underlying health problems that go with that probably should be losing weight if they really are scared of the virus. Do you want to talk about that for a second? That's a bit of advice, right?
Well, you know, that's kind of me throwing it in the faces of people who are trying to take my freedom away, if I'm being honest. There's not very much good faith behind that particular argument.
It's actually a good point, though.
It is a good point. No, it's a valid point, and it's a completely justifiable thing to say that if you are somebody who's going to tell me that I am a jerk for refusing to wear a mask, because in all candor, I do. I refuse categorically, the only exception being when I am in my business capacity because I have a fiduciary duty to, you know, put my personal preferences aside in that case. But in my personal life, I've been completely civilly disobedient on this point, and I'm in a state where I can face fines or jail time on it. And, you know, when people say that I'm a jerk for doing that, and they were obese when the pandemic began and they gained 30 pounds since, and they're telling me that I'm putting them at risk, it's just hypocritical and it's just ridiculous. And I have gone through an experience very recently which shows me that they can, in fact, do something about it. And the fact that they don't shows that they're kind of full of it. You know, they're hypocritical. They're not very serious about their presuppositions, and they are trying to impose something onto me without making the changes that they are supposed to make on their own. So, you know, even though it's not necessarily a troll, because like you said, it is a valid point, but it's not necessarily a point that I make with the thought of the people who I'm talking to are going to receive it well, but it is the truth. And I think that it's something that's worth pointing out, that the people who are making these Karen arguments to you are not actively trying to reduce their own comorbidities if they have those, then they're not serious about it. And it's justified to call them out.
Right. Well, what I think happens, and I'm just guessing here, I think people psychologically compartmentalize. We often think that something won't happen to us. We know that we can all get hit by an oncoming car if we're not careful. But we don't walk around with that constant fear hanging over our head. And I think that applies even in the case of COVID-19. You feel like you're doing what you should be doing. You're wearing a mask out in public, even though it probably is useless. But nevertheless, as Olaf stressed, you have that psychological security, because you actually believe that masks will work, right? Because you've been told that they do something, not nothing. The government would just lie to our faces, would they? Well, so I think even when people are overeating as a form of comfort during this COVID-19, maybe they're worried about job insecurity, it doesn't matter. Even if they're just gluttonous, period, I think they psychologically compartmentalize. And this isn't really an important point, because I get what you were saying. If you're aware of the threat and you're concerned about the threat, you should be concerned about reducing your risks in terms of your health. But I still feel like people say to themselves, unconsciously in a way, well, that won't happen to me. I'm doing really what I need to be doing. So I'm not too worried about that. So I think it becomes ineffective in a way. But I think if you bring it to people's attention, then they might think for a moment, hey, wait a minute, he has a point. Maybe I should be going for a walk after dinner, doing a little more exercise, et cetera, or doing any exercise for that matter. So I think it's a good point to make, but we have to be careful the way we make it, I suppose.
Well, yeah. You know, what's interesting, Lee, is that if somebody made that argument to me and said, well, I don't think it's going to happen to me, in most cases, my argument would be, yeah, fair enough, you're probably right. I mean, mm-hmm. If you are somebody who is around my age, which most of the people who I interact with typically are, if you're somebody who is even in their 30s, 40s, and you're, obese, but not extremely obese, you're not sitting there at 400 pounds, you're not in class 3 obesity, the truth is that your risk factor, in addition, is not all that high, according to the studies that Johnny Anitas has done. So I don't really begrudge people who are obese and getting fatter for thinking that it's not really an additional risk to them in a major way to die of COVID. In most cases, they're probably correct if they don't have other serious comorbidities. But I think the point is that if you're going to make that argument, then you then have to accept that me living my life as I see fit and doing so in a way that might, in your mind, cause you a higher risk to contract this, even though I don't think there's any real evidence of that. I mean, even the CDC, you'll notice they never say that this will protect you. They say that it may protect you in every single statement they make. But, right. If you think that this is going to protect you, that's fine. But you should be protecting yourself more in that case. And if that means that you have to be reducing your comorbidities, then, at least you're being consistent in that case. But when you want me to take protective measures, but you won't take protective measures on your own, that's when I start to get, a little bit upset at the hypocrisy.
Sure, that's understandable. I think we should probably wrap up at this point. I think Olaf has another engagement. We appreciate both of you coming on and sharing your thoughts. Did you any final comments, Timo or Olaf?
Yeah, the thing is funny. I agree with Rocco. When you have people at the grocery store, I don't know if you have somebody who weighs 300 pounds at the grocery store and complaining that you're not wearing a mask and think that you should be mandated wearing a mask, then I think I should be allowed to just go and grab all the soda out of your cart, all the frozen pizzas out of your cart, put it back where it is, because we're all in this together. You can't go around being obese. Like, should I have to pay with my tax dollar for your hospitalization? Come on. We're all in this together. You can't buy those things. Put them back.
Right. That's an element of progressivism right there. Yeah. We're all in this together.
Yeah, I mean,
the health of the nation is at stake.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, it's amazing. I think the people below 50 in Sweden, of all the fatalities now that we have like 5,500, 1% have been people below 50, the age of 50. 1%. I mean, that's like 55 people. So... Yeah,
and they probably had underlying illnesses, right?
Oh yeah, I mean,
any of those cases?
Probably. I don't know exactly how many, but most likely, yes. Most likely, almost all of them did. They were either obese, they had diabetes, high blood pressure, or some other autoimmune disease, or they were cancer patients or something like that. Yeah. No, this is a disease for a specific group of people that you can make an effort to protect, but it's unreasonable to think that you can just shelter everybody in their homes. And by the way, if you're ever going to overcome something like this, I mean, usually in the past, when you have looked at other pandemics, the way you overcome them is either you find there is a vaccine. Okay, fine. But now that's a whole other discussion. But either it's that, or you have sufficient developed immunity among the general population that it becomes much more statistically hard for the virus to find a non-immune host to infect. And I think that's pretty like safe to say now, if you look at the curve of the virus, the infection rates, and also ICU rates and fatality rates in Sweden, that you can see a clear effect of some type of herd immunity that exists. Like two of my brothers had COVID in Sweden. They're fine, and they have antibodies now. And that happened to a lot of them. So the more of those people you get, you know, when the virus can sort of plow at a, you know, slow but steady rate through the healthy population, and that population develops a shield to protect the vulnerable, that could also be a desirable effect. Even though that's not the primary goal of your strategy, that could very well be a byproduct of your strategy and a favorable outcome.
Well, I think we've hit the hit, right? The herd immunity threshold. And we've therefore covered the most important bases. And I really thank both of you, Olaf and Rocco. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you both.
So there we have it. Sick Transit Gloria Locofoco. There endeth the 18th episode of the Locofoco Netcast. I want to thank, once again, Rocco and Olaf, and Lee C. Wiggs, who did the yeoman's work for this episode. And of course, at Locofoco, we have only yeoman and no yes men. You can find Locofoco Netcast at locofoco.net, which is the SoundCloud host. You can find it as a podcast on Apple, Google, Pocket Cast, and Spotify, and other podcatchers. The community is at locofoco.us and locofoco.locals.com. Thank you.